Well, let's take your phone calls this hour now with planetary scientist Daniel Derda, and we'll do that right after this. Well, welcome back, Daniel Derda with us. Daniel, in terms of things going on in our own solar system, of course, Saturn's moon, Titan, full of methane. What other great mysteries are out there? What do you think's going on Europa?
Oh, Europa is a fascinating case. This is a one of the four big moons of Jupiter. It's not a whole lot dissimilar in size to our own moon. And Europa is really interesting because it has it's probably the one place in the solar system that has more liquid water on it than our own ocean planet Earth. The story with Europa, though, is that ocean is hidden below this icy water, icy crust over the surface. So you look at Europa, we see this, it looks like Antarctica all over the surface, right? It's this big icy crust.
That's right.
That crust,
but it's deep,
cracked.
Right?
We know from the geophysical data, the gravitational perturbations from spacecraft as they've orbited in that system, that that the interior, though, is melted. And we don't know exactly how far down below that ice. That estimate ranges anywhere from just, you know, almost near the surface in some spots to as much as 10 or 20 kilometers down. But
wow.
But someplace down there, we know there's a significant amount of water. And if you, you look at the moon just next door to Europa called Io. Io is twisted and pulled by Jupiter's gravity to be one of, not just one of, it actually is the most volcanically active object in the solar system. Right next door, though, Europa goes through similar tugging and pulling. It's that icy surface is cracked all over. And that tells us that down deep below that ocean, that rocky core below that ocean, I would be very surprised if there wasn't some sort of, these hot geyser-like, thermal vent sort of
sure.
things like we see down in on our own ocean floors. You couple that energy source with liquid water. Folks are very, very interested in looking at Europa as a potential place for life in the solar system.
Could be. Now, but if there is life, life has to have something to eat, right? It's got to feed on something. What do you think's there for them to eat?
Well, here on Earth, that food source, that ultimate energy source is dominantly, at least for most of the life that we interact with, it's dominantly the sun. And so plants evolved to take literally just the water vapor out of the air and the carbon dioxide out of the air, use sunlight as an energy source
That's
to
right.
rearrange those molecules and make hydrocarbons, carbohydrates, sugars that the plants use for various things and that we as parasites in the plants have ended up finding a pretty yummy food source on ultimately. So that uses sun as the energy source, but there are plenty of things we're learning now about the mechanisms and biology that are very creative and adaptive at using other energy sources. And we've now found that there are entire communities of life centered at these hydrothermal vents at the bottom of the ocean, deep, dark blackness that's darker than anything we've ever seen, using not sunlight, but the chemical energy of the sulfur-containing molecules in the materials coming out of those vents and the heat of the vents itself as an energy source to manufacture the molecules that life then uses for energy. So you can have entire food chains that aren't necessarily based on sunlight.
All right, let's go to the phones as promised. We'll go to Bellingham, Washington to start. First time caller, Nathan's with us. Nathan, go ahead, sir.
Hello, George. Hi, Daniel. It's my first time calling.
Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm a big fan of movies, and one of the movies that came to mind while listening to the program tonight was Armageddon.
Yes.
And so I kind of have a two-part question, I guess. In the beginning, it's like I was wondering if there was actually an asteroid that did wipe out the dinosaurs. And then secondly, if the type of scenario were to come up that happened in the movie, would we currently have the technology and the know-how to avoid that an asteroid hitting uh-huh. Earth?
Oh, two great questions. Good stuff, Nathan. Thanks. So question one, the evidence for an asteroid impact actually wiping out the dinosaurs, that was an extremely controversial proposal back in 1980 when that was first proposed. We'd known for, centuries that there was this mass extinction. Dinosaurs are no longer with us, obviously, thankfully, in some ways. And so we've known about the mass extinction at the boundary between the Cretaceous period and the Tertiary period that we're living in today. This KT boundary is marked by those extinctions, but in In 1980, a pair of scientists, Louis and Walter Alvarez, father and son team, were working in Italy, mapping some seafloor sediments that were laid down across that KT boundary, and they were interested in measuring the the rate at which those sediments were put down. They weren't worried about impacts or things like that, but they were just looking at how fast those sediments were put down. And they were using the infall, the slow, steady infall of cosmic dust on the Earth all the time, and the iridium, platinum, rare earth platinum group metal, relatively abundant in interplanetary dust, as a sort of a marker of the rate at which that dust was being put down and those sediments were being laid down. But they found that right at the boundary itself, there was a huge spike in iridium. I mean, just thousands of times more abundant than the background, and that piqued their interest. And when they sort of calculated, well, gosh, how much cosmic material coming in all at one time would be, would you need to make a spike that big? And it, when they ran the numbers, it turned out that it added up to something like an asteroid 10 kilometers across, 6 miles across. And it kind of hit them as like, holy cow, this might be the actual source of that extinction itself. It might have been an actual cosmic collision. Back at that time, it was, that was the idea, but there was no evidence for an actual impact at the boundary, at that point in time, 65 million years ago. Around 1990, though, the Smoking Gun crater itself was actually discovered in the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico. And so, over the intervening years, as people have researched that crater and the details, that's one of these transformative paradigm shifting events in science where all the evidence comes together in a way that you just have these aha moments. And it's now, pretty much one of those. It's about as firmly established as anything can possibly be in science. Big impacts are bad things for sure. Now, if something like that were, the Armageddon movie scenario, or the other movie that came out about the same time, Deep Impact, two movies made with this realization that we're living in this cosmic shooting gallery, and is there anything that we can do about it? There's a kind of a flippant statement that, well, the dinosaurs went extinct because they didn't have a space program. But we do, and we could actually use that technology to our advantage. And this is the one natural disaster that we actually could prevent. Now, an impact of that scale right now, today, probably not. I have to tell you, really, quite frankly, we were just not prepared for something of that scale to be able to actually physically do anything about it. Unfortunately, it's a sad truth, but it is true. The good news is that the surveys, the telescopic surveys that are responsible for finding all these things, have kind of put us in the clear. This used to be something we worried about back around 1980, 1990, but the subsequent searches have showed us that for objects of that scale, over the lifetime of you and your children and our grandchildren, that's not something we have to worry about, thankfully. So that's money well spent.
What about wormholes? Can we get sucked into one? Could the entire solar system, galaxy, get sucked in by a wormhole?
I guess if there was some stellar mass black hole wandering through our stellar neighborhood, and were to pass it deep enough and close enough through our solar system, it would certainly cause, you've got all the gravity of that stellar perturber, in one point source moving through the solar system. It would cause a significant perturbation to the orbits of the planets in our solar system, that's for sure. But one thing I think we want to kind of dispel the myth of black holes and these sort of things acting like big cosmic vacuum cleaners out there in space. It's the same gravity that the sun has, right, or any other object, it's all focused in one point source rather than a distended source like the sun. But the effect of a stellar mass black hole passing through our solar system would be no different over the broad scale of the solar system than a star passing through the solar system. So wouldn't be a happy event for sure, but. I don't think we'd be disappearing in a flash of light, that's for sure. Not from an event like that.
West of the Rockies, Victor is truck driving in California and on the air. Hi, Victor. Go ahead.
Hello. Daniel, got a question.
Sure.
Protocol. If you find something just astounding, what's the protocol of who you tell and what do you do about it?
All right, what's our procedure? If you find an astounding thing, Daniel, how do we do it?
Excuse me, cough. I'm getting over a cold.
All right.
Yes, there are protocols, and I'm assuming if you're, you know, discovering something like an asteroid, we had this situation I described earlier where one of the folks we funded from the Shoemaker grant actually discovered the asteroid that has been in the news last week. In the case of discovering an asteroid, if you're an amateur astronomer and your CCD camera happens to capture one of these objects, the place to go is the Minor Planet Center in Massachusetts. There's a Google up the Minor Planet Center on the web, and they have a procedure for reporting the sky plane equivalence of latitude and longitude that we use for locating positions here on the Earth. There's an equivalent system up there in the sky called right ascension and declination that we use for reporting the positions of objects in the sky. And those are the kinds of coordinates that you would report to the Minor Planet Center. And the object is given, once an orbit is connected through the positions for that object, it's given a provisional designation. And then in the case of an asteroid, if you're the discoverer of an asteroid, you then earn the right to, you maintain and earn the right to get to name that asteroid, which can be a lot of fun. I've discovered any myself, but I've actually been responsible for naming several asteroids after some NASA test pilots I flew with and the producer-director of the Babylon 5 TV series and things like that. It's been a lot of fun. So getting to name one after yourself is pretty cool.
Sure
it's
is.
Even better if you discover a comet. Unlike discovering a asteroid where you get to name it, if you get to discover a comet, it's even better.
It's your name.
Usually they end up naming the comet after you.
That's right.
So you want to go out and discover comets. That's the fun.
Shoemaker, Levy, things like that, right?
Absolutely.
Let's go to Oswego, New York. Tim's with us on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, back in like the late 70s, early late 60s, early 70s, there was a green ball of fire that came across the sky. It lit up. It was just after dark, and it lit up like daylight, but everything was green.
Sounds like
a
meteor.
Did that event ever record it?
What you saw was most certainly a bolide, a pretty, I want to say a common event. It's not common to be that bright. I mean, it's kind of a rare and fun thing to get to witness. So you're very lucky that you got to see something like that. I've been watching the sky for all my life and I've only seen one or two reasonably bright sort of things.
And they go by so fast.
Yeah, they go by so fast. So you gotta be just really lucky to see something like that. So what you saw was most likely, if it was really bright enough to really flash and light up the sky, you're looking at something, you know, maybe marble size or walnut size passing through into the atmosphere, a piece of rock. I mean, you witness the end of a piece of stuff that made the planets in the solar system that has been wandering out there for 4.5 billion years. And you got to see it on the day of its death in the Earth's atmosphere.
How could an object the size of a little marble or a grain of sand cause so much light when you look at it?
Oh, it's a phenomenal amount of energy that's dissipated in the atmosphere. When an object that comes streaking in at 20 or 30 kilometers a second, the energy of motion of an object is dependent on the mass, the size, but the mass of the object. So that's important, but not nearly as important as the speed. If you double the mass of something, the energy that it's going to deliver when it stops goes up by a factor of two. If you double the speed of the object, the amount of energy that gets delivered goes up by a factor of four. It goes up as the square of the speed. So as you ramp that speed up, the energy that gets deposited goes up really fast. And so most asteroidal material entering the atmosphere is coming in at 20-ish kilometers per second. That's, think about how much energy the space shuttle would dissipate when it re-entered the atmosphere from low Earth orbit at 5 or 6 kilometers a second, right? We're coming in at speeds that are 4, 5, 6 times that. You're talking, 16, 25, 36 times the energy. And so, a little sand grain or a marble or a walnut's going to punch a lot of atmosphere into the atmosphere when it reenters. The green color that you would have witnessed, the light that you're seeing from one of these things is not necessarily coming from the vaporization of the little object itself. Most of the light that you're seeing is coming from the shock heating and the stripping apart of the air molecules in the atmosphere around that object as it's heating the air as it passes through, and then the reassembly of those molecules back into the sort of standard state that they were in. And as those ripped apart atoms and ions recombine, they give that energy back off in the form of light. And many of the transition lines due to oxygen and nitrogen will give off that sort of a green color.
Do you think that objects in space, Dan, like nebulas and things like that, could be alive? Maybe not as alive as we are as human beings, but there's some life to it, because they all look like they're giving birth to stars and things like that.
Yeah, there's that. I mean, you know, certainly from a literal case, they literally are giving birth to stars, and it's. I mean, there's that sort of. We want to, you know, anthropomorphize the sort of things that are going on there. There's been a lot of actually. Fred Hoyle, a British astronomer from the 20th century, wrote interesting science fiction story about. Based on thoughts of the actual science of it, could actual interstellar clouds in some sense be living entities? You've got all these dust grains that have got organic molecules in them that, as they bump and grind together, they can, you know, produce little electrical charges and, you know, in a sense maybe transfer information back and forth in that way. And he, you know, sort of, as a thought process, wondered if maybe these whole interstellar clouds could be living entities, and he wrote a interesting short science fiction story on that. But there was, you know, there's a little bit of science thought he put into the sorts of things as well.
Let's go to Chris in Tampa, Florida, where the Republican convention will be in August. Hey, Chris, go ahead.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Good.
I had a question for you guys.
Okay.
I had a question and a comment. Earlier, George, you mentioned that. You know, maybe some of the people around the world, they might retaliate with nuclear weapons if a object was to hit the Earth. I was reading about Russia might have a dead hand. I don't know if you heard about it, the dead hand project they might have.
Explain.
If something hits Russia that resembles a nuclear weapon and...
they launch, right?
Right. They automatically launch, supposedly. That's something secret. I'm not sure if it's true or not. And my second question was, if, you know, something sizable was to hit the moon or something, could it knock it into our orbit and cause a collision?
Well, that's an interesting question. Can anything change in orbit? Well, didn't that earthquake in Indonesia change the rotation of the planet just a bit?
Yes, it did. In fact, when you have a significant enough shift in the Earth, in the mass of the Earth's crust, it actually, you know, it affects the you know, it's like having a top spinning. If you were to throw and stick a lump of clay on the spinning top, all of a sudden, the wobble, the spin of that top gets all upset because the mass distribution within that top has changed. Same thing happens when the physical body of the Earth itself distorts. You can certainly do that by distorting the shape of an object and affect its spin that way. You can affect the orbit of an object if it's actually impacted by another object in a large enough sense to cause enough of a momentum shift to actually affect the orbit. That certainly happens with asteroids all the time. That's how some asteroids are moved from positions in the main asteroid belt to other new orbits. Now, to change something like the orbit of the moon would require an impact that, I mean, you've got the entire mass of the moon to move. You've got to sort of add up, you know, what sort of momentum change that would take to make it.
That would have to be a huge impact. Daniel, we're coming back with final phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, the greatest storyteller ever born, Lionel Fanthorpe, joins us with some incredible stories. So sit back and relax. When we come back in a moment with Daniel Derda, we'll talk more on planets, asteroids, and comets on Coast to Coast AM. With Daniel Derda. Daniel, we sure are getting our money's worth out of the Hubble Space Telescope, aren't we?
Oh, absolutely. Fantastic instrument. It's life is limited now, though, unfortunately. No more shuttle missions to go up and resurface it and boost its orbit. So it's... The clock is ticking, unfortunately, but absolutely fantastic stuff still coming.
When it goes sent up there in what, 1990, I think?
Yes, sure. I was there at the launch. I think
were you?
Yeah, I was there. Yeah, I, in fact, That was right when I was still a graduate school at the in graduate school at the University of Florida, and I used to do a lot of reporting for the local museum there on the shuttle program. And so they would send me down to every launch as a press accredited person, and I got to see. I think the final count was something like 27 space shuttle launches up close.
Will it eventually crash to the planet?
Yeah, it'll do like many other satellites have, re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, burn up, break up. It's a big enough piece. It's a big enough satellite that some pieces of it will probably survive intact down. Most likely, the Pacific Ocean is the biggest target on Earth. It'll end up splashing down bits and pieces. Most likely, someplace there.
When might that happen? Do you know?
Gosh, you're putting me on the spot because I haven't actually looked at what the drag rate is on that. I don't know exactly what its final lifetime is, but it's probably measured on something like within the next decade.
I mean, it's in a low Earth orbit, isn't it?
In comparison, I mean, when Hubble was launched and then resurfaced over multiple missions, it was some of the very highest orbit shuttle flights that were ever made, and it was being put up as high as possible. Up to altitudes as much as like 500 and 600 kilometers up. So, in an effort specifically to try to prolong its life as long as possible.
Sure.
But even that though, it's a big object, a lot of drag, and eventually it's coming down. Unfortunately.
All right, back to some final calls. Judy in Burbank, California. Hi, Judy. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for being on. It's terrific.
Sure,
I was just wondering if a powerful asteroid were to go through a black hole, number one, would it ever be seen again? And number two, would it have any devastating effect or any kind of effect in the black hole at all? Or do they know what would happen to it?
Daniel, once it goes in, it doesn't come back, does it?
As far as we know, no. There's a lot of smart folks who try to work on the physics of what happens once you pass down into that little rip in space time, as best we understand it. What happens on the other side of that, I think, is probably only people like Kip Thorne and people like that best understand. but going in, I can tell you, it's a terrible environment to go through. You're going to be that asteroid's going to be pulled and stripped into a little strand of spaghetti as it's ripped to dust and fall through the event horizon of that black hole. It's going to give up a lot of energy in the process. Just like when you drop a marble on the floor, it falls and gives up that gravitational energy, converts it into energy of motion. When it hits the floor, it goes snap. It makes a sound because it's hitting something solid there on the ground. When you're falling deep into the event horizon of a black hole, you've got nothing solid to hit, but you're giving up that final bit of energy as it crosses that boundary, and usually it's in the form of X-rays and gamma rays as it passes through.
There are other universes on the other side of the wormholes. What do you think?
That now we get into the regime where I think probably only 5 or 6 people on this planet understand the mathematics of that well enough to really kind of get a sense of what goes on. But that's the basic idea of a wormhole, that some of the mathematics that describes that really extreme regime of physics best kind of approximated as sort of a passage through to some other place in space-time, some place else physically in the universe and some other point in time, as best we can understand it. It's that's the stuff of science fiction, though, for sure, no doubt.
Let's go to Racine, Wisconsin. It's Tim's turn on Coast to Coast. Tim, thanks for holding.
Hey, thanks. Sure. Great show, George and Daniel.
Thank you.
I got a couple of things, actually. I've seen that grain thing, actually, too, like the ball, a couple of times.
Oh, yeah,
actually.
Very common. Yep.
Yeah, but my question is, what about like an extraterrestrial helping, move something? Or if you could set something up on the moon, like a laser or something to maybe capture it. Maybe get
to kind of help with this threat. There are a couple of things we can do. And when I mentioned the fact that there's really not a whole lot we can do, that was really in reference to the very biggest of the impacts, the sort of the dinosaur, the species killing sort of thing. When you're talking about these more small guys that we're discussing, like 2011 AG5, this football stadium sized guy, then there's a lot of things we can do. And that's a different story altogether. And that's why that's a particularly interesting story these days, because it gets us right into this decision making process of when do you decide to do something and what is it that you decide to do? And the reason it's interesting is because we actually have things that we can think to do, like a gravity tractor or this is where you park a spacecraft next to the asteroid and use its the self-gravity between them to to tug the asteroid along with the spacecraft. There are kinetic impactors, like we actually tested with the Deep Impact mission to Comet Tempel 1 back in 2005 when we ran a big copper projectile spacecraft into the comet to study the cratering physics. But the same basic idea with a bigger spacecraft, a bigger impactor, and a smaller asteroid, you can give it enough of a wallop to actually affect the orbit of the object and maybe affect an actual deflection maneuver to prevent the object from hitting us. And then, you know, as a last resort for, you know, maybe a little bit larger object, there's always that final nuclear option, which it seems to be the Hollywood option of choice, but it really is kind of our last option of choice. But, you know, for certain classes of objects, it would actually work to you know, literally, in some cases, literally nuke the thing to bits, or more precisely, what we would end up doing is using a standoff deflection maneuver where you detonate a nuclear device off the surface of the asteroid, but use the absorbed radiation pulse from the detonation to vaporize part of the surface of the asteroid and create sort of an artificial jet, if you will, that would nudge the asteroid off course. So there are options at our disposal. We just have to be smart enough and decisive enough to watch the situation and take action when we think it's finally appropriate.
We go to Camino, California. Art's turn, west of the Rockies. Hello, Art, go ahead.
Gentlemen.
Yes.
There seems to be more and more compelling evidence that there are solar systems with planets.
Absolutely.
Which is pretty
thousands
exciting.
And thousands.
I'm a wildlife biologist, and we, of course, use relatively small samples to extrapolate wildlife behavior and populations. Now, okay, we have one tiny sample here, Earth and our sun. Is it reasonable to extrapolate that out to the many hundreds, thousands, billions perhaps, of other solar systems with planets that could possibly contain life?
I guess depending on which direction you want to go with when you mean to extrapolate out, I think the answer to that could be both yes and no. I think absolutely yes from the point of view of the diversity and sheer number of systems that we already know are out there. It's not even speculation at this point anymore. Through ground-based observations and now especially the Kepler mission, as we discussed earlier, as you pointed out, we know decisively that there are just thousands and thousands of other specifically known systems, and then you extrapolate those numbers through the rest of the galaxy, and it literally is just billions of other planetary systems in our galaxy alone. And then if you want to then extrapolate to, you know, the properties of what extant life might be on these other systems, that's where we get into a more fuzzy situation, because as a wildlife biologist, you know full well that the evolution of life on a planet is a pretty, you know, the natural selection forces that push you into one design versus another and so on. There's certainly, you know, convergent evolution, but boy, you know, I don't think we're going to find anything in the galaxy even remotely resembling what, you know, I think the most bizarre life forms that you can pick from the bottom of the ocean here on the Earth are probably much more familiar than anything we're going to find in, you know, other systems out there. It's the universe is far, far more imaginative than we are, and I suspect that there's going to be some stuff out there biologically that would just absolutely confound us if we were presented with this. That's the beauty and the majesty of it. I think there's just so much out there waiting to be discovered. It's awesome in the original real meaning of the word awe.
Well, Daniel, this planet is, of course, teeming with life. I mean, it's absolutely stunning.
It's hard to go anywhere on this planet where there's not life.
I know.
From our perspective, macroscopically, we look around and, you know, okay, rainforest. Oh, yeah, there's lots of life. But then you go to the Atacama where it's a very dry thing, and it's like, oh, it's just a lifeless place. But that's our biased opinion as these big macroscopic animals. There's practically no place you can go on the planet and not find just swarms. It's a bacteria planet. you go kilometers down deep into the crust of the Earth, and we've pulled up rocks that have got bacteria living in the cracks in the rock from kilometers down. So it's a biologically jam-packed planet, and that at least from this one example we have, that seems to just be a natural property of life itself that wants to find and exploit every little possible niche it possibly can. And if that's a universal property of life, then I think pretty much any planet that we find out there that has got life on it will be packed with life, if it's gotten to that point at all.
Let's go to Henderson, North Carolina. Colleen, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi, Daniel. Thank you for taking my call.
You are welcome.
This is one of my favorite subjects, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay.
But with all the different space debris that we have rotating around our planet, I know that, you know, there are some different theories that the sun itself can affect asteroids. Well, how about our space debris? Can it start pulling asteroids in as well? Because I know that the moon itself is being slowly pushed away, you know, from our planet because of what we have out there, and we keep putting more and more up every day.
There's almost 20,000 objects, they said.
Oh, at least.
Larger than 10 centimeters.
I know. For, you know, from the size of a little screw up to, you know, the everything else orbiting up there. And I'm wondering if it really could pull, you know, asteroids in. If they get near enough to the space debris, could it act as a secondary
magnet
gravitational field?
Interesting question.
Well, yeah, absolutely. There's, close passages of asteroids by the Earth will affect the debris in orbit around the Earth as well. There'll certainly be a perturbation there. There are a lot of folks really worried about the space debris problem that we have created ourselves in orbit around the Earth itself. Every satellite we launch up there is a potential source of bad stuff to affect other satellites. Paint flecks, the fragments from explosive, you know, pyrotechnic bolts that separate stages of spacecraft and the bits and pieces, collisions between spacecraft, either accidental or on purpose, create debris. And some folks are worried that we are going to be soon approaching a stage where we hit a runaway cascade of collision debris that will be very difficult to clean up once it actually starts. The atmosphere itself of the Earth itself is probably the very best cleaner we have for low Earth orbit, at least. What we think of as the vacuum of space orbiting in low Earth in the low Earth environment, where the space shuttle flew, where the space station flies, where Hubble is right now, as we discussed, it's not the pure vacuum that we normally think of. There's still enough distended atmosphere up there that it causes a drag over time and causes this stuff to, over the years and decades, to spiral inward. So in a sense, there's a natural cleaning mechanism. Where we're most worried about are the higher Earth orbit positions where that debris doesn't get naturally cleaned out. You mentioned sunlight effects, and that's a very good point, because in fact what we have learned about the effects of sunlight on asteroids changing their orbits over time, we learned how that works from actually observing the effects of sunlight altering the orbits of artificial satellites in low Earth orbit. And so, in fact, it is true that sunlight is a perturbing effect on some of this debris and does affect its orbit.
Let's go to Stilton, Wisconsin. Brent is with us. Hey, Brent, thank you.
Aha, you took me by surprise. Glad to meet you there. Hey. Glad to talk with you there. George and Daniel, I've got a theory here I'd like to present to you.
Okay.
Is it possible that another galaxy can collide with another galaxy?
We see it not only possible, we see it all the time. There are beautiful, we've talked about Hubble and some of the amazing observations and new things we've learned from Hubble observations. Hubble has presented us with some of the best images of the after effects and the ongoing process of collisions between galaxies. It's a very common thing because galaxies actually tend to live in clusters with each other.
Isn't Andromeda coming this way, Daniel?
I'm sorry. Yes, Andromeda. I was gonna move in that direction. That we ourselves, our own Milky Way galaxy, is destined for a collision with the other large galaxy in our little local group of galaxies, the Andromeda galaxy. You can actually see it with your naked eyes in the sky. You look up and there's this fuzzy patch in the sky. It's our fellow traveler in our local group of galaxies, just slightly larger than our own Milky Way. We're on a collision course with the Andromeda galaxy.
Okay, then that leads to my next question here.
Yep.
As we all know, that Mars has something happened to Mars, and there is out there an asteroid belt.
Mm-hmm.
As from what I know is that asteroid belt used to be the planet Sumer. And I'm thinking that this rogue planet, Nibiru,
which could be that extra planet. Go ahead.
Yes, that could be like Pluto, way on the outskirts of this another galaxy, coming through our solar system again, and, you know, wreaking havoc again.
Mm-hmm.
But, my theory is I look at the pictures on Mars, and, you know, if you look really close, you can see structures and things like that, as well as, well, there's that asteroid belt that goes all the way around the, you know, our little solar system there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the theory right there. Could that possibly have happened? And as we go through this huge cycle, you know, the Sagittarius Corpicon or whatever you call it, you know, and that now we are entering, like you said, there's going to be another collision of some sort.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, yeah. So let me describe the difference in scale.
A minute left here, Danny.
We're really writing down here. Okay, very quickly. When galaxies collide, the stars in those galaxies effectively never collide. The spaces between stars are literally like, imagine the dot on an eye on a printed page. Stars on that scale are separated miles apart on that scale. And so when galaxies collide, the stars pass right across and past each other without ever actually going through physical collisions. So galaxy collisions are impressive on the big scales, but on the scales of solar systems, we could go through such a collision and never even know it.
Ah, so why do they say collision?
Well, it's at the scale of the object you're looking at. So, you know, at that scale, the matter of the galaxies themselves kind of merge and pass through each other. But on the scale of the constituent bits and pieces of the galaxy, it's effectively a non-event.
Next up, we're going live to the United Kingdom. Daniel Durda, thank you so much. We will still watch the skies.